Hi, folks. This is Izzy from Science Education Solutions, and I'd like to share our first podcast in a new series connecting teens and scientists. In the series, we will share real interviews with teens and scientists that exemplify the idea that teens have gained a more realistic picture of scientists as real people leading interesting lives. Teens Gus Pedrotti and Jimmy Schneebeck attended a recent Café Scientifique talk by Russell Morton, researcher at the University of New Mexico in the College of Medicine. The teens interviewed Russell on April 17, 2013 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, following a popular informal science talk. Prior to hearing their interview, let me tell you a story about Russell to give you an idea about his struggles and his character. Russell has many interests, among them exploring the great outdoors. The summer before Russell was ready to launch into high school, he had a serious life-altering accident while hiking with friends. He fell from a waterfall onto rocks below. Search and rescue carried his unconscious body 2 miles out to a helicopter, and he spent 3 hours in the emergency room, 9 hours in surgery, but the lucky thing was he was still alive. He suffered countless lacerations, a cracked skull, 2 cracked vertebrae, 2 broken collarbones, 7 broken ribs, a collapsed lung, and a completely shattered femur. To make matters worse, a 6-inch pocket knife was embedded into his hip, and he suffered a broken pelvis. After almost 2 weeks in the hospital, he spent 1 month in a wheelchair and 6 months on crutches. Finally, with the help of countless hours of physical therapy, Russell's orthopedic surgeon took his crutches and told him to walk out of his office. He walked away with a serious limp, half of a fake hip, a metal rod down his leg, and a newfound fascination in biology and medicine. Now you will hear the interview between Gus, Jimmy, and Russell.
How do you feel that your life-changing incident before high school affected your entry into the sciences?
I think it had a big impact on me entering sciences. I mean, I was never super devoted towards science or anything, and that really kind of sparked my interest, especially in medicine. And then later on in undergrad, I mean, I didn't really do it justice tonight and either in my bio, but I mean, that was a big game changer. I had just determined I was going to go to medical school. And my experience in my undergrad lab was amazing. You know, in undergrad we take all these class labs and they're awful. They never work. Like, the calculations are always wrong. You know, it's awful. So when I got into a real lab, I realized, you know, the things that I do every day, there is no answer. No one knows what I'm testing.
Yeah, if you're right or wrong.
Yeah, and that's the cool part. And half the time, or more, you're usually wrong, right? But then you just rebuild your hypothesis and try something else. And that has been really cool. I mean, I'm also really into how things work, even mechanical things. So, you know, I've always been tearing apart my car and everything else ever since high school, you know. So how things work has just always been really interesting to me.
So from your incident and wanting to understand, I guess, the mechanics, it sounds like you were going to be more focused in ortho or something. So what made you go for neurosciences over that?
That's a really good question because, again, I'm a true believer that you have to surround yourself with people you enjoy. And so when I went into graduate school, I was pretty dead set I was going to do cell biology because I liked the basic mechanisms of how life works. But I ended up rotating through a neuroscience lab, and I loved the people. I loved the PI, the professor, and we just had this great connection. And I was like, what the heck, you know, let's try neuroscience. And that just kind of sparked me on, and I'm glad it did because I've really enjoyed neuroscience since then, and I think it's so cool how we can, you know, really try to pick apart how our brains control our behaviors and everything like that.
So. Definitely. And so this professor you just talked about, was he like your biggest inspiration, or who was that along the way for you?
My biggest inspiration I'll give two. One, my biggest inspiration to stay in science was my undergraduate research advisor. And then once I was in science, yeah, it would definitely be my graduate advisor. He played a big role in me staying in neuroscience and starting something. I mean, I started to... I record those electrical currents from individual neurons with a technique called electrophysiology. I would have never, in my wildest dream, would have ever thought I would have done that. I took electrical physics in college, and I hated it. I'm like, this is the worst thing ever. Why would you ever need to know this, right? So then I get into graduate school, and I had to, like, relearn all that stuff that I didn't learn because, I don't know, I just, you know, it wasn't interesting at the time.
Yeah.
And but then when it was the... our biological systems are creating that electricity just clicked for me, and yeah, I had to go back and relearn it.
So what was like the path you took from, I mean, when you were an undergraduate student through when you got your doctorate, like what did you major in and what kind of like things did you focus on that took you to where you are?
So I have a very meandering type of history, which is good. I think it's good to live life as full as you can. So I actually did my first year of undergrad at CSU in Fort Collins, and most of my friends had gone to CU, and I was very isolated. So I ended up transferring after my first year to go to CU, and absolutely loved it. Like, we just had the best time. I mean, there's nothing better than, you know, living in Boulder, and we were climbing every day and running.
Exactly.
And it was fantastic. It was so fun. So that transfer took a little bit more time. So it took me like basically 5.5 years to finish undergrad, mainly because I was doing so many kind of extra classes for medical school, because that's where I thought I was going, and just, you know, trying to take my time in undergrad because it was a good time. So I did that, and then so after I got my undergraduate degree and decided to stay in research, I wanted more research experience. So I worked as a technician for a year in
Denver.
What
was your undergraduate degree?
Oh, sorry, it was in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology. So that's where I got hooked on like cell biology, basic cell biology. So then I worked as a technician in Denver at the Health Sciences Center in a bacteriology lab working on microbacterium tuberculosis, which was cool. I don't necessarily like working with human pathogens every day. The fact that you might get infected someday is high. So that was very fun. So I did that. And then while I was there in Denver, that's when I met my wife, Jen, and she was finishing her graduate degree. And she was going to do a postdoc in Washington, D.C. So I decided to go with her, hold off on graduate school, and then I went to D.C. After working another technician position, I entered graduate school from there. So it was a very long process because I took 5 years for undergrad, basically took like 2.5 years off, and then started grad school. So,
but it worked.
It does work. It's been fun.
Yeah.
When you're, you know, 35 and getting your first job, it kind of sucks. But it's been fun, so you can't complain.
And I mean, your job now, you work with fetal alcohol syndrome, right? So how did you become interested in that, and what's your favorite part about your job?
So I got started in basic alcohol research during my graduate lab. I was in the National Institute for Alcoholism and Alcohol Disease, and so there I was exposed a lot to you know, chronic alcohol usage, addiction, all that kind of stuff. And then when it was time for me to then go on to do a postdoc, we had decided to come here, and there's actually a pretty large group here that does fetal alcohol syndrome. And, you know, since I've transitioned to that, it's actually been really neat. And it's a complex problem that you would think would have an easy solution, right? Just don't drink during your pregnant, you know?
Yeah.
But people do it all the time.
Yeah.
And even doctors now will even sometimes suggest, you know, a few drinks a day is not harmful.
A few drinks a day?
Yeah.
Sounds like
which is considered moderate.
Sounds like it would be helpful.
Yeah. So we know from what we do in the animal studies that that is harmful. And it probably shouldn't be advised, but you know, people still drink.
Logic.
But I think the most exciting thing on a daily basis is I get to ask questions, you know, like how
professional problem solving.
Exactly. And it's been so fun. Like you say, like you get results in one day. And how do you explain it, right? You got to come up with something else. How can I test it?
Right.
And that's one of the things I personally enjoy is I love the challenge of how do we answer this question? You know, can we visualize it? Can we record its activity? We have to come up with some way. And I think that's been really fun for me because then I get to build things.
Yeah.
And so we're always building new electrodes and we're building this and building that and trying to come up with a way to answer a specific question. And that's the best part. I mean, there's not many people who say they just get to sit around and think stuff up and then test it, you know. So
you just think for your job.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's really fun. I mean, it's frustrating sometimes because science is not easy. A lot of experiments don't work. But when they do, it's so fun. I mean, we just got a new transgenic mouse that we're working with, and the whole lab was recording that day, and as soon as someone would get a result, they'd be throwing things down the hall to get the attention of other people. And I mean, it's just super fun. I mean, we have the disco ball going and stuff. Like it's a cool environment, and it's not many opportunities like that. So
from going from a technician and now to being kind of the head of teams and stuff, how do you see, or how have you seen the change in technology? Where is it going, and what are we expecting from it? How do you use it?
So that's actually, I think, one of the coolest things about neuroscience right now. It has just been exploding with new technology. I mentioned that protein we isolated from algae that we can actually induce
that's unbelievable
electrical activity with light.
said that and we just kind of
did he really just say isolate a protein?
And it's awesome. I mean, that's the coolest thing. I mean, we can stick electrodes into a rat's brain, record individual neurons when they're running around doing behavior tasks. We can, you know, now use optogenetics, which is that light activated protein, to activate activity. It's just, it's been really cool. What we can do now has never been before. And we joke about the two guys that I do the zombie talk with. We always joke that, like, as kids, we loved, like, sci-fi movies, you know, and like RoboCop and that kind of stuff. And now with neuroscience, I mean, we're there. We are very close. We have patients right now. So one of the guys is working at Carnegie Mellon, and they have amputee patients that they actually have electrodes implanted into their arm or into their brain, either or, and they can control robotic arms, and they can actually feed themselves and do basic tasks. I mean, that's been the coolest part. I mean, we're really doing some really fun, cool stuff that was science fiction 20 years ago. I mean, RoboCop was just like, wow, it's crazy, you know? Yeah. And now we're actually doing it.
Yeah, like building that kind of stuff.
And it's pretty cool. And, like, for instance, another group, they've actually recorded from live humans what kind of activity they see in the visual cortex when they're looking at individual pictures. And they can actually, they wrote an algorithm from what activity from those neurons they can then remake that image of what they showed the patients. It's unbelievable stuff. I mean,
no, they can't.
How do you even come up with wanting to do that? I mean, that's unreal.
How much do you kind of like overlap? I mean, is there any overlap between like the neuroscience, chemical kind of stuff and psychology, softer science, like behavioral development and like
cognitive, all that stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually another really cool part. Before, like 10, 20 years ago, those two fields were like this.
Right.
I mean, we're now like this. We know what neuronal circuits control certain behaviors.
Yeah.
And, you know, for instance, like today, I was training animals to learn a certain behavior. I mean, to navigate through an open field to find a reward. And we know what neuronal circuits are responsible for how they navigate through that space. And, I mean, now we're right there. We're talking all the time now, and like I even do experiments in the psychology department here at UNM because he has the person I am working with, he does the human part of how what tactics we use to navigate through a novel area. Like when we walk into the room, what do we use to navigate through the tables to the TV? So combining them has been really, really cool.
So you're like working a lot of decision making and where that comes from and how it happens, or?
Yeah, a little bit. The coolest thing I talked about in my talk, the hippocampus, and that's involved a lot in memory, but also in this spatial navigation. And so what we know now is that if we record neurons in the hippocampus, when an animal or a human is actually walking in a novel environment, there's actually what we call place cells. So individual neurons within the hippocampus will fire when you're close to that door, but when you're close to that door, another neuron will fire. And it creates
like
this virtual map.
And you have pinpointed these specific neurons.
So cool.
Yep. And we can record from it, and it's dead as day. That every time an animal approaches that door, that neuron will fire.
Across the board.
Across the board.
And then, so will it like develop? Will you develop new neurons, or are there just neurons that aren't used when you go into a new place? Like, do you just have an unlimited amount of these that you can just...
So there actually is some new neurons made in the hippocampus. In the very, very first... The hippocampus is a circuit of three different regions, but in the very first region, there is new neurons. There's some idea that that the new neurons play a role in that, but it's more that there's a lot of neurons in there, and every time you approach a door, that neuron might fire again, but also another neuron that's more associated towards the whiteboard. So the combination of those two neurons.
So it's like kind of recycling and combining.
Exactly. How the whole network together fires can create this map. So it can be reused, and that map can also change.
Right. Yeah.
So the cool thing is if we have an animal in a certain arena and they're walking around and we have these place cells, if we take that arena and we shift it 90 degrees, all those neurons still fire in the exact same positions as they used to.
Really?
So it's all about what information we're receiving from the outside world.
So when you're insulating those like pathways, like is it detracting from other pathways? I mean, so how is that affecting myelin sheaths in other areas versus the one that you keep testing?
Yeah, so that's part of the problem, right? So, we obviously know that we see our environment. We know that somehow those place cells get that information. And actually, today or yesterday, there was a paper that just came out that somehow connected those two regions. So there's another region called the thalamus that is kind of a relay system for a lot of things. And there's actually a connection between the visual cortex to the hippocampus. So
you figured it out.
A little bit, yeah. There's a chance that's the pathway. But, you know, we as basic scientists sometimes get really excited about, you know, that one neuron that's firing next to the door, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But it's really the whole thing that controls it.
What about when you're dealing with memories of places, or like if this room got demolished and rebuilt in a new way and then all of our sensors were, how would they still be there and just not used, like that kind of combination?
Yeah, so one thing we sometimes do is once an animal forms their spatial memory of whatever context we have, we change little things. And sometimes even just putting a new object in that environment will only slightly shift their visual map or their memory map. Others, it will completely change. So they'll make up a whole new virtual map of that whole area just because one thing changed. And we don't know why that is. We don't know why sometimes it only slightly changes and sometimes it completely gets remade.
Right.
And that's one of the questions that we have is,
So what kind of like advice would you give to a student who was hoping to go into a field like yours or any sort of science field, I guess?
Man, just be inquisitive. Ask questions. I mean, that's the best part of science, and that's what drives all scientists. Asking questions, how to figure out how things work and how biology works, and just keep that hunger.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that gets you through some of those times when experiments aren't working. You want to just give up, but you just keep that persistence and always ask questions about the world around you.
Yeah.
I think that's what we needed to cover on the recording. So, thank you for that.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please listen to our next podcast in the series, Connecting Teens and Scientists.